This is a recording from the Jefferson Society at the University of Virginia. For more information, visit jeffersonsociety.org. On October 26, 2007, the Society hosted Paul Bibeau, the author of Sundays with Vlad, From Pennsylvania to Transylvania. Mr. Bibeau was introduced by author Jonathan Coleman.
When I was an undergraduate here, I had a professor named John C. Coleman, who's actually quite legendary at the university. There's a chair in the English department called the John C. Coleman Chair. I, in fact, am Jonathan Coleman, no longer teaching here, but I was teaching here for 7 years. And during that time, Paul Bibeau was a student of mine. And I still live here in Charlottesville. I'm a full-time author of literary nonfiction. It's been a wonderful pleasure for me in the last 2 weeks to have two students of mine come out with their first books. And one of them I had the pleasure of introducing last week in Knoxville, John McLaughlin, who was class of 93, but I don't know if he was a member of the Jefferson Society. And Paul Bibeau, who was class of 92, who was a student of mine in the fall of 1990. And one of the things I always tried to tell Paul and any student I ever taught was, hang around a situation long enough to see things change, to see people change. And in that regard, I'm glad that I've known Paul for as long as I have, because I couldn't quite figure out why he was so jumpy as a student of mine. I mean, I understood the sort of neuroticism, the tenseness, the excessive curiosity, but it wasn't until I realized that he had this deep-seated interest in Dracula, and you know, when I found out he was doing this book, things, as they say, sort of came into sharp relief for me. He is a, I should also say, and I only mean this half-heartedly, I was always afraid this was going to happen, which is to say that he was going to follow one of the most unstable, uncertain paths anybody could ever follow, and that's to become an author. But I knew he was going to do it, because he was too interested, too determined, too wanting to know how it all fit together, wanting to ask people questions, determined to find out the answers, but always with a great, great love of whatever it was he was pursuing. And I have to say, in the class I taught Paul, we always read travel writing. It was one of the things. We read writers like Jonathan Raven. And on some very significant level, Paul really does a writer like Jonathan Raven proud, because he pursued this Dracula story wherever it took him. And it took him, and this was another sort of funny coincidence, it took him, and I think you'll really, you know, be delighted by this book, it took him to Wildwood, New Jersey, where, and something that he didn't know about Wildwood, New Jersey, is that when I was in high school, I had a job in Wildwood on the boardwalk every night running a ride called the Monster's Den. And I want to tell you, that was the single most stressful job I've ever had in my life, because the ride would often, night after night, stop. And if kids were in the car as it was riding through the Monster's Den and a monster was about to jump out, the ride would stop and a parent would have to go in and get him. So I'd be running back and forth because of this faulty ride to sort of capture these kids who were about to be sort of you know, just about to go into the mouth of the monster. So, again, I had no idea until I got the bound galley of Paul's book, The Manuscript, that he had gone to Wildwood. And he delightfully sort of gives you a history of Wildwood, and also the whole sort of history of these carnival rides, these scary carnival rides. It's all in there, but the key to this book is Paul. He is the most wonderful guide throughout all of this, never for a second failing to poke fun at himself, and just having a very good time along the way. I want to say one thing, because I have met his wife, and he speaks of his wife quite often. He says in the book, in the bio, he says that he doesn't own a cape because his wife won't allow it. And she is an incredibly sensible woman who at the same time allows Paul to be Paul. And here is Paul. Paul Bebo.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, I'm not going to live up to that. So we're going to talk about the history of Vlad the Impaler, Vlad Sepes, and how he became Dracula, how the historical figure of Vlad became the literary icon of Dracula, and then how he became a pop culture icon and how he became a star. And we're also going to talk about Keanu Reeves, and we're going to talk about the horrors, and I mean horrors of funnel cake. And we're going to talk about a guy who's running for a political office, for president, actually, on the Vampires, Witches, and Pagans Party. And if elected, he promises to impale criminals on the White House lawn, but he's a progressive as well, so he's going to be conducting gay marriages on the White House lawn as well. And because he is a satanic dark priest, he is capable, evidently, of performing wedding ceremonies. You might not want to do the Ave Maria at the reception, but there it goes. So we're going to go through a lot of different aspects of the Dracula myth, and I'm going to try not to be boring. But the first thing we're going to do is commit an act of cultural vampirism. Who wants a delicious, and I've had this several times, a delicious recipe for paprika hendel? It's a chicken, paprika chicken. The Hungarians use it with a great spetzel recipe. I got it off the web, but it is the recipe of the food that that Jonathan Harker eats in the opening pages of Dracula. Who would like to make chicken paprika? I don't mean now. I mean just, you know, who might have some use for a paprika? Thank you. And you see, what I did right there in transferring the information to this woman who now can do with it whatever she is, I am doing exactly what Jonathan Harker did in the opening pages of Dracula. Before we meet the Count, before we talk about soil or blood or, you know, going into a foreign country and buying up all the land and stealing the women and all the stuff that all the pomo litcrits talk about when they talk about Dracula, the first thing we're talking about is that Jonathan Harker finds this interesting recipe for a chicken, you know, done up with paprika, and he puts this little notation in, memo, must get the recipe for Mina, you know, his wife, Mina Harker. And the idea is, right there at the beginning, Jonathan Harker is about to appropriate a little piece of culture from Transylvania and bring it back home and then cook the dish, you know, unzip the file, so to speak, in his English kitchen. And the fact that this information vampirism is connected to the act of eating is supposed to make it even creepier. And then when he goes on to Castle Dracula, Dracula himself, one of the first things he says to him is he shows him his English library. And he talks about the fact that he himself has compiled this list of the social registry of London and the people who are in the civil service, in the British civil service. And he basically is telling Jonathan Harker, I have enough information to go into English society and blend in. And what was fascinating to me is the fact that 100 years before the internet was invented, 100 years before the guy on the YouTube did the Numa Numa dance, and the only reason you all know about that Romanian pop song is because that one guy in Jersey was doing do-do-do-do. Before 100 years before that happened, Bram Stoker touched on one of the central vulnerabilities of a culture, which is that it is composed primarily of information. And because it's composed, a culture is composed of information, it can be invaded, appropriated. It can be sucked out and brought to another place. And if you've ever gone to Vegas and gone to the, you know, the Egypt, the Egypt pyramids in the Las Vegas casino, you know what I'm talking about. But that's enough for now. And I want you to, I'm going to point that out again later. But for now, I'm going to talk about how I destroyed my honeymoon. Here are some words. This is how the book opens. The guard, polite and menacing, stepped in front of us. He gripped a wicked-looking submachine gun. He seemed barely old enough to drive. "Can I help you?" he asked. "Where are you going?" It was really a demand, not a question, and my wife, Anne, and I couldn't answer. We glanced at each other nervously. We seemed out of place, anxious, guilty of something, like we were hiding a secret. And we were. It must have been obvious. Because soon, half a dozen more guards swarmed us, all of them armed, and I was sure something terrible was about to happen. It was a bad way for a honeymoon to end. We'd raced into the airport at Bucharest with no tickets, no reservations, and no idea where we were going. It was late in the evening, and we were practically the only passengers in the cavernous building. The departure board posted a single flight to Tel Aviv, and when the guards spotted us, we were actually debating whether to buy a pair of tickets right there and then and hop onto it. Hurried, out of place, and ridiculously early for a flight we weren't sure we were going to take. The guards didn't know what to make of us. They asked us what flight we were waiting for, and we couldn't tell them. They asked us where we were going, and we couldn't tell them that either. Neither of us wanted to admit the truth, which was this: anywhere, absolutely anywhere, we want a seat on the very next plane flying out of this stupid fucking country, and we don't care where it's going. It could be headed to Vienna or Djibouti or one of those remote research facilities in Antarctica where an alien life form has just killed one of the staff and mutated into a hideous parody of him, and now it's picking off the rest of the terrified scientists one by one. That would be a Cancun sunrise compared to this godforsaken crap heap. But you don't use words like godforsaken crap heap to talk about the country a 19-year-old kid with a submachine gun calls home. We couldn't tell them the truth. So my wife and I found ourselves sticking to the story that we were anxious, secretive travelers with no reservations who might be headed to Tel Aviv. Looking back on that, that may have been a mistake. But it was the latest in a long series of screw-ups that began when my wife said we should spend part of our honeymoon at Castle Dracula. I know you don't believe it was my wife's idea that we said, no one does. When I tell people she suggested it, they look at me like I just said my wife suggested we have a Super Bowl-themed wedding with the priest dressed at Ditka, or decorate our apartment entirely with inflatable furniture, or have a three-way with a Hooters girl. But it's true. Anne's an attorney, so before writing this book, I had her draft something up to make sure the whole story was on the record. After you've read it, you'll know I wasn't to blame. And I actually have the affidavit of Anne Bebo, my wife. I'm just going to read the important points. I admit that I consented to Mr. Bebo's itinerary. While my aforementioned consent was freely given, it was not fully informed. Specifically, my consent was given without knowledge of the following key facts. Vlad the Impaler's castle is not in fact a castle, but is more aptly described as two piles of bricks, one dating from the 15th century and the other from the 1970s. Vlad the Impaler's castle is not in Transylvania, but is in the Romanian province of Wallachia, an economically depressed industrial region littered with failed construction projects and empty factories covered with moss, scrub brush, and what appear to be wild goats. Wallachia is infested with feral dogs that roam the streets in packs, harassing tourists and locals indiscriminately. She goes on at some length. And obviously that raised more questions than it answered, and I'm probably not the first person to learn that there were troubles in his marriage from a legal document. But the thing is, the day before, you know, Thanksgiving, 1998, I asked my wife to marry me, and she said yes, and the marriage was in September of 99, and we wanted to take a trip overseas. And I'm Irish-French, and my wife's like Scottish-Irish, so between the two of us, we have the pigment of like an eighth of a person, you know, so we're not beach people, you know. So we were doing the Eastern European tour. And at some point, I happened, you know, we both happened over this this guidebook that that said, noted for its monastery and the legend surrounding it, Curtia, and this was the city, it was called Curtia Dargish, also serves as an excellent base for adventurers seeking Count Dracula's real castle. And that's all they had to say, Count Dracula's real castle. And what I began to realize, you know, over the course of writing this book and all, is that no such thing exists. I mean, there isn't a castle Dracula. There's the remains of this fortress that's connected to a historical figure, and then there's the spot that Bram Stoker set way over, you know, a 12-hour drive in Transylvania. And then there's the place that supposedly inspired Bram Stoker, only it really didn't, that's in Cruden Bay, Scotland. And basically, the legend of Castle Dracula was just that. It was every bit as legendary as anything that Bram Stoker had ever come up with. And the story of how a historical figure named Vlad Sepeš got turned into this literary novel became so fascinating to me that I kind of had to explore further. So we almost destroy our honeymoon. We go all the way to the middle of Wallachia. There's a steep climb of like 1,500 steps up the side of this mountain. It goes in the middle of this forest. You think you're going to die when you're halfway through because it just is. It's not built. Nobody built it. They cobbled it together in places, and you're crawling up, and you finally reach the end where there's a little plank bridge that looks like it would have gotten an F in high school shop class, and then you go over, and you see this thing that's supposed to be the massive and stately Castle Dracula, only it's really, it's not just that it's a pile of bricks, it's small, it's tiny, tiny, it's about, the entire site is about just the block of space inhabited by the people here. You know, basically, it's the kind of thing that if you were building a castle at the top of a frickin' high mountain and you had to carry or, you know, get, you know, dragoon the peasants into carrying a bunch of blocks up the side, you wouldn't build the frickin' Taj Mahal at the point of a mountain. You'd build the very smallest, very most defensible place you could. You would build a frickin' shack, a bunker. You know, and in fact, the more I walked around it, and this is the castle that actually people talk about when, you know, the Bram Stoker's Coppola Dracula is supposedly based on the legend, the initial introduction in the movie when little Winona, you know, Gary Oldman's dead and Winona's all upset and she, you know, flings herself down into the river. That is actually based on a legend of the life of the historical Dracula. Not anything that Bram Stoker wrote, but it's based on the life of a legend from the life of the historical Dracula whose wife thought they were going to be captured and she cast herself into the Argesh River. And that castle is the one we visited. But it's tiny. It's a beach house. It's a frickin' beach house. It's the kind of thing that you would be holed up there with about five of your buddies, and you'd be playing Monopoly for, you know, the winter because you can't get down once you get up because it's 1,500 steps up the side of a mountain. Anyway, when I came back a couple of years later, I found out that the government of Romania, you know, they survived communism and came out from under it back in 1989, and the country was economically depressed for like, well, it still is, but you know, it was in an economic disaster, a free fall, you know, throughout the early 1990s, and one of the things that they were discussing was the fact that you know, at trade fairs, they could start stamping artifacts with the letter D for Dracula, because Dracula is the thing that they have. It's the thing that the Romanians have that it's saleable. It's a trademark. It's intellectual property that you can actually get your hands on, and you can turn it into wealth. So they went to trade fairs in Germany with the goods of Romania, the export goods of Romania, stamped with this D. And they generated a lot of interest. And pretty soon, people decided that what we really need to do is to build a theme park based on the life of Dracula. And they actually were calling it Dracula Land. And it was supposed to be set in Sighișoara, which is, it is actually in Transylvania. It's the home, the birthplace of the historical Vlad the Impaler. But of course, the problem with Sighișoara is it's one of these well-preserved medieval jewels of a town that's in the middle of Transylvania, and it's a UNESCO site. Everybody in any kind of NGO that wants to protect it, you know, has it on its list. You know, and so immediately they ran into all kinds of trouble, you know, with people protesting. Prince Charles actually visited the area and protested and stuff. And the Romanians tried to get an organization that they called Greenpeace Romania to approve of it, to get the sort of green stamp of approval. But pretty soon they found themselves in hot water with the real Greenpeace, because Greenpeace Romania was this complete fiction that the government, like, you know, invented to try to, like, dodge around. I talked to this guy named Hervik Schuster, who's like the Greenpeace, you know, rep, and he was pretty, he didn't see the humor in it, you know, at all. So the point is, at some point, I started investigating that for an article I wrote for Maxim magazine in about 2004, and I began to realize that the Romanians, as much as we had turned Dracula into an industry here in the West, the Romanians could not turn him into something to make them money, you know, back in his homeland, back where he was born. I mean, Vlad the Impaler, he's there. You know, the whole country is filled with places that he slept and, you know, that he ate and that he crapped and that he killed his enemies and stuff. And you can't throw a rock without hitting, you know, Dracula-related sites. And they can't turn this thing into a theme park. What I describe it is it's like the vagrant wandering around with the big wire cart, you know, filled with bottles of nitrate and empty aluminum cans, and he somehow has this well-preserved Van Gogh original in his cart, but he doesn't know what he has and he doesn't know how to do it. And then I found the kicker of all kickers, which is that the actual rights to the image of Dracula is not owned by the Romanians at all. It's owned by Universal Pictures in Hollywood. So if the Romanians ever finally get their theme park, they're going to have to kick money to the LA lawyers, you know, for a cut. And the other thing I found was that the body even is not where they say the body is supposedly. The monastery that supposedly holds the body of Dracula has never been sort of verified. And in fact, recently, like as late as 2002, 2003, some scholar in Romania, you know, released this report in which he made a very convincing case that the headless body of Vlad the Impaler has actually never been found, that he was buried in the bottom of a monastery that was then burnt down, and all traces of the foundation have been lost in time. And that's not even the skull. The skull of Dracula was sent overseas, you know, so the Sultan could put it on a pike, you know, after they beheaded him in 1476. And they chucked it down a well somewhere in Istanbul. And the only way you're going to be able to tell what the skull, where the skull is that it smells like a 500-year-old box of Honey Smacks, because they packed it in honey for shipment. So I have Universal lawyers. I have a dead body that's in the south of Romania. I've got this skull in the bottom of some Turkish well. And what I really want to do is get a bunch of maps, get a GPS, and get a small team of people and start digging holes. But then the question is whether I want to spend the next, 25 to life in a Turkish prison for violating their landmark or Romanian prison. And instead, what I decided to do is to begin to unearth these different connections between Vlad and Dracula. Now, where we start is actually not anywhere near those places. You know, after I went through all that and I talked to all the Romanians, I um, what I realized is that two of the most important documents in talking about the legend, how the two legends became intertwined, are actually located here in America. They're actually located in Philadelphia. In fact, the Rosenbach Library in Philadelphia has the existing notes that Bram Stoker used when he was compiling Dracula. And in fact, Bram Stoker, during the 7-year period that he was writing Dracula, he came back and forth between London and Philly. He was actually in Philly. And some of the notes are written on the stationery of a Philadelphia hotel. Philly also has the only surviving copy in North America of an anti-Dracula pamphlet, an anti-Vlad the Impaler pamphlet. You know, I'm sure you've seen the woodcuts of those things. If you've ever watched, you know, Leonard Nimoy's In Search Of, and you see the guy, you know, impaling stuff. Usually what you're looking at is a woodcut from one of these incunabula that were part of a mass market smear campaign that the Saxons launched against Dracula, you know, back in the late 15th century. So I had to go see that. And I ended up as a clove of garlic in a Philadelphia parade. Let me, encased in a giant bulb of garlic, I'm stumbling near blind through the streets of downtown Philadelphia, dodging horse crap. The bulb is a monstrously heavy papier-mâché contraption that swallows my upper body like a mascot costume for the world's lamest team. Coming onto the field is Clovey, trying to whip up the crowd and lead State Agricultural's fighting produce to victory. Go produce! The costume's wooden harness digs into my shoulders, and I don't have enough headroom, so I have to either stoop like Igor or stand straight and let it compress my spine. Either way is ugly, so I alternate stoop spine, and I can barely see through the tiny view hole as I follow the rest of the Dracula parade, held every Halloween by the Rosenbach Museum and Library, along with a puppet theater group called Spiral Q. I'm dodging the horse crap because they shoved me behind an old gypsy wagon drawn by an animal that must have had a very healthy lunch. I can't see right in front of my feet, and I skip to the left and then to the right, trying not to ruin my shoes as the musicians in the wagon play some creepy accordion tune over and over while the parade makes a meandering loop through the area. A bike messenger zips in front, and then another garlic bulb crashes into me, jolting me off course. I turn around clumsily for a look, but all I can see is the giant sculpted head of Nosferatu behind me, his eyeballs twitching wildly as if he is drugged. His creator, Beth, told me she'd made him from a photo and never even saw Nosferatu or even read Dracula. Beth used to be with the puppet theater group, but she's on her own now, and she only comes back to do maintenance on her head. She's a short, cute woman with brown curls and a strange orange jumpsuit, like she just escaped prison. She's also wearing a pointy cap that might be some kind of Transylvanian boyar's hat, but I realize later that her outfit is just something from a thrift store that's supposed to be hip. And if an old guy like me can't understand what it is, it probably qualifies. And then I found this interesting thing about Spiral Q, the puppet theater group. What is it about these progressive groups and their puppet theater? Like, they really, it pisses me off. Early afternoon, August 1, 2000, police on horseback surrounded a warehouse that Spiral Q and other groups were using to store their supplies for massive protests against the upcoming Republican National Convention, called the Ministry of Puppetganda by the protesters. The building held 135 cardboard skeletons for the prisoners Bush executed while governor, and Corpzilla, the capitalist pig, a giant cardboard hog dressed in a tuxedo and mounted on a 48-foot flatbed truck. There was a standoff for hours, with police dropping onto the roof from helicopters. Finally, according to then-director Matthew Hart, the police told the activists that if they left the building, they wouldn't be arrested. So they left the building, and the police promptly arrested them. The case went to trial, but the charges collapsed for lack of evidence. Puppetry is not a crime, Hart said to reporters during his trial. And what the the group said was that they did it to shut him up. And of course the police all said, no, we didn't. They just didn't have all their, you know, paperwork in order. And a good friend of mine who's like a high-level attorney in the Philly government, he said, and I use a pseudonym to protect his identity, he actually told me, of course they did it to shut him up. They didn't want them to fuck with the program. And he doesn't think it was for politics, like the Philly government was like secretly Republican or something. He said it was for the tourism dollars. They wanted all that money people were going to spend on blow and Ukrainian hookers. It was a great line. Just, you know. Anyway, so I go to this place, and I participate in the parade. But what I'm really there for is that the museum holds this parade, and the museum does this tour of, you can see the Incunabula, and you can also see they do a sort of talk about the different pieces of paper that Bram Stoker has written notes very clearly. And those pieces of paper, they tell you something very, very, very specific and about the legend of Dracula, and it's something that people, scholars, have been getting wrong for years. And that is this, that Bram Stoker knew next to nothing about Vlad the Impaler. He didn't know he impaled people. He didn't really know where he was from. He didn't know which specific Dracula he was talking about, because there were, you know, multiples. Vlad was like Vlad the Third, his dad. It's a long story. But he didn't even know that Vlad was Vlad. And what happened is that Bram Stoker, he kept a very detailed list, because he was a personal assistant to one of the biggest actors of the era, Henry Irving, a guy that everybody back then knew who he was, and very few people know today. But he was like this personal assistant to this guy, this hyper-organized person who has to follow him around and make sure that the schedule is on time and make sure his luggage gets with him to the hotel. And so as a result of being the type of person he was, Bram Stoker wrote everything that he was thinking while he was doing Dracula, while he was writing it. And he kept a very detailed list of all the books that he read in the course of researching, you know, his topic. And one of the books, the one that refers to Dracula, is this history of Transylvania. And it mentions that there once was a guy named Dracula who was very famous for fighting the Turks. And that's about it. So years later, scholars begin to write about Bram Stoker knowing about how he must have known about this guy, Vlad the Impaler. And they began to speculate about all the things that he must have known. And the fact that Vlad the Impaler was this bloodthirsty guy who impaled people. I mean, think about the act of impaling versus what you do to a vampire at the end when you kill it, how it just fits perfectly. And they, with this serendipity, the scholars really couldn't help themselves. They created this legend that he must have known, you know, all these things that he did not know. But what's very clear in the notes is how little he knew. And the other thing that's very clear is that he began the outline to Dracula without even knowing that he was going to write about Dracula at all. In fact, his original notes of Dracula, the story takes place not in Transylvania at all. It takes place in a town in Austria called Styria, which is famous for being the birthplace of Arnold Schwarzenegger, of all people. And the second thing is that Dracula himself was not Dracula, he was Count Vampire, you know, or Count Vampire. Now, another vampire tale had been written around, a few years earlier. I believe it was Carmilla by Sheridan Le Fanu, and that took place in Styria. And so some of the speculation is that Bram Stoker wanted to separate himself from the other Victorian vampire novels. He reads about this crazy guy, Vlad, and what he learned was that the name Dracula literally means son of the devil, okay? And in fact, in the notes, it actually has Dracula equal devil, you know? And you could tell, you could see the light bulb popping up, like, wow, that's a cool name. And then you can see later his notes of this story in which he's crossed out Styria and he wrote Transylvania. And he's crossed out Count Vampire and he writes Dracula. And the rest is history. You know, And of course, the problem is Bram Stoker got even that right. Even that wrong. Even the definition of Dracula. Because technically, the name Dracula means son of the dragon, and it was based on this military order that Vlad's father, Dracul, had gotten. So anyway, Stoker knows next to nothing. He finds this neat name. You can see very clearly in the notes where, you know, the creative process is working, and he's basically in his notes he's writing, Dracula, cool, devil, wow, that's a great villain. And then he crosses it all off. And the problem is the historical figure of Vlad is so close to the literary figure that, you know, scholars have a hard time unsorting them. Okay, so after I start compiling the history myself of Vlad the Impaler, and one thing we find out about Vlad the Impaler himself, even the historical figure, even before he gets kind of turned into this ghoul, okay, is that Vlad the Impaler himself may have been slandered. Himself. I'm not saying he's not crazy. He was meaner and crazier than Courtney Love during an intervention. But the problem is, the problem with Vlad is, he picked on one group of people who were in Transylvania called the Saxons, a Germanic group of people who had moved there, and he was hitting them up, not just with the impalings and the various persecution, but he was also taxing the hell out of them. And these Saxons started to emigrate back to Austria and to Germany, right about the last half of the 15th century. And the other thing that was happening in the 15th century is that Gutenberg's printing press was beginning to pop up with copies all over that very area. So you've got this crazy band of pissed off immigrants coming back with these stories about this guy who's taxing the hell out of them. And they run smack dab into a new form of technology that makes communication much easier. I mean, anybody in this room, you know, knowing what you know about the 21st century, knowing what you know about every political campaign, maybe in the last 10 years, maybe in the last 20, is you get an angry group of people plus a new technology, and one thing you get is porn, but the second thing you get is crazy political tracts. And that's what happened. Those German printing presses were producing more copies of anti-Dracula pamphlets by the end of the 15th century than copies of the Bible. Now think about that group of people, you know, printing more anti-Dracula pamphlets than copies of the Bible. You know, to this day, that, you know, my copy editor actually, are you sure about that? You know, because it's, you know, it's almost inconceivable how many things these were. So Vlad, for that little bit of time, right after he died in 1476, he's beheaded by Turkish thugs in the swamp. But by the end of the 15th century, Vlad had become this kind of micro-sensation in that part of Europe. And of course, after that, you know, people, you know, he goes into the history books and he becomes this figure, this colorful figure, that, you know, he's at the back there. He's not one of the most important leaders. But the meme, you know, the idea of Vlad, this crazy, you know, bad guy, is there for Bram Stoker to find a couple hundred years later. And so it's kind of like the guy gets slandered once and then he gets turned into a ghoul. And then, you know, Hollywood takes over and, you know, they never saw it coming. Okay, so after this, I tried to track down one of the first places in American pop culture where this connection between Bram Stoker's Count Dracula and Vlad the Impaler actually came together. And it's a Castle Dracula ride in Wildwood, New Jersey, the place that Jonathan Coleman told you about. In other words, it's one of the earliest theme park attractions that combined imagery of Bram Stoker's Count Dracula with the imagery of the guy impaling people. It was an actual theme park ride, and this was built in 1976. So this is before Elizabeth Kostova's Historian, you know, takes the figure and reimagines it. This is before the Coppola Dracula. This is like very early on when scholars began to get interested in the so-called real Dracula and kind of repurpose him, right? So I go to this carnival town called Wildwood, and the name of the chapter is Funnel Cake and Arson, because that's what I dealt with. Let me read you something. Funnel cake is never a good idea, but you don't remember that, and you fool yourself every time. You walk by the concession stand, and that smell hits you. That heavy, sweet smell of grease and dough and warm kitchens with something baking in the oven. And you don't even think about getting a line. You don't even think about fishing crumpled bills out of your wallet, and it comes out of the dark screened window, hot on the plate, dusted like an early morning frost. And that first bite is crisp and rich and full of memories of every carnival you ever saw. Knocking the milk bottles over on the first try and hefting that impossibly large panda out from behind the booth and giving it to your best girl. The first bite fills your belly and satisfies you in a way that nothing has in years. The first bite is everything you need. Funnel cake should come in pill form. You'd take a single bite every Monday morning to replenish your youth and wonder and get you through your work week. But funnel cake does not come in pills. It comes in one size only, a hot, greased chunk as big as your head. And while the first bite is wonderful, the second bite is where you realize you've just eaten a handful of Crisco and cake frosting. The second bite of funnel cake reminds you that the milk bottles were welded together, and even if you hit them directly, the ball would just bounce off. And you didn't have a best girl, just a carny giving you the eye, a carny with an odd number of fingers and prison tats on his paws. He pulled the lever to lock you into a tilt-a-whirl that looked like it was made out of scrap iron. And as it whipped around faster and faster, you saw the chubby kid two seats over begin to make ominous, silent, heaving motions. And you realized you had a second to close your eyes and mouth before the ride became a vomit atomizer. The first bite is Ronald and Bozo and Red Skelton. The second bite is the Joker and John Wayne Gacy. The second sinks into your gut like it will never, ever leave. And after that one, there are more. Your hands are greasy. Your chin is covered with spit and sugar and acid burns the back of your throat. But you can't stop, can you? You go on wolfing it down, queasy, disgusted, but you absolutely won't throw it out. You hunch over to keep the sugar from blowing away and indulge your filthy habit. Your stomach tightening like it's Thanksgiving afternoon in hell. And you know somehow you have to finish. So you do the only thing you can. You grab your friend, your relative, someone close, someone you love, and you betray them. Here, you say, giving them half. Help me. Like a family of junkies getting each other hooked, you huddle together feeling hateful and sick. And if you recover, you promise yourself you won't ever eat this crap again. Like any addict, you lie, and when you can't lie anymore, you make yourself forget. Anyway, what time is it? How much time?
It is 8:17.
So we're okay? Yeah, cool. So anyway, my buddy Kenan and I had to bring a friend to Wildwood. We go down to find this supposed Dracula carnival ride that combines all the vampire imagery, and I write about funnel cake because we have this big chunk. And we're in the middle of this. It must have been some kind of, you know, rainstorm, because the sugar is just blowing all around us. And when we finally get there, the ride seems to have burned down. And the thing I find out about Wildwood is that if you don't like a ride in Wildwood, wait 5 minutes and someone will torch it up. And I recount the number of fires that engulfed the Wildwood boardwalk. And it's like every 3 or 4 years they have a major one. And then every 1 or 2 years they have a couple minor ones. And one of the big, you know, one of the scandals or one of the rumors is that people are constantly torching their place up to collect the insurance money to come back in the next season and reopen with more money. You know, that's the way you do it. But, you know, it's hard to nail down exactly who, you know, it's hard to separate the insurance fraud from the cases of just, you know, your typical Jersey Ute with a Bon Jovi t-shirt and a lighter just wandering in and torching it up. And the problem with the Wildwood Boardwalk, I found as I started reading the fire administration literature about this, is that it doesn't have enough of a sprinkler grid to get water pressure all the way onto the boardwalk. You combine that with the fact that you've got the ocean air blowing thick, impassable smoke back into the entire area, so you can't see see a damn thing once you get a good fire going. And the fact that in the off season, Wildwood's almost completely, the boardwalk part of it is almost completely empty. So you could get a fire going, large portions of it are made of, very dry wood that's like 128 years old. So you just like look at it and it bursts into flames. But one of the things that happens is that you can get a fire going and nobody knows about it until it's almost too late. And then they cobble together, a massive fire crew, but they can't bring the water to it quickly enough. And so a lot of they have a lot of fires, and then they have fires that are very, very dangerous, And so they had this one blaze that torched the Castle Dracula ride just straight to the ground. And, Kenan and I spent the rest of the day in Wildwood wandering around trying to find pieces of the ride. And we stumble onto this historical center where they have a giant, fiberglass kind of, crest from the Castle Dracula. But all they'd done is cobble together the crest of the English throne. Like you could tell with the lions and the unicorns that it was just a British crest. It wasn't like Transylvanian or anything. But you could still see the burn marks on it. And the guy, the historical guy, this, really ancient bald man who was very angry all the time, he said that the guy, one of the firefighters actually brought the crest in after the fire while it was still smoking. And he just gave it to him and he said, here, hide this before someone steals it. And it became part of the Wildwood Historical Center, part of the lore. So Kenan and I, after we find that out, we're kind of wandering around different places trying to talk to people that might have known what, about the history of this carnival boardwalk ride. And we find ourselves, I'm Irish, so I do most of my research in bars. I do. There's a large portion of it. So we're in this VFW center, right? And we're talking to all the locals. And they're all talking about how the Castle Dracula ride was this place that you when you're a teenager, that's where you take your girlfriend and your neck because, it scares her and, ooh, that's great, So, but one guy, three sheets to the wind, he looks at us and he says, the guy that runs that the ride, he's king of the gypsies. And he keeps saying it. He's king of the gypsies. The guy that owns the Wildwood attraction, he's got some. And he keeps, and at first I'm like, well, this is just some drunk guy. But I look it up, and it just so happens that Mr. Nickel, who runs the ride, and his entire family, Nickel's Midway Pier, they're this very prominent Roma family. That gypsies, the politically incorrect term, but they're a very prominent Roma family who run carnival attractions in Wildwood and elsewhere. And, the guy wasn't that far off. He was a member of a lot of, Roma organizations. He had a lot of political power. And I even ended up interviewing the guy. He's this older guy, about the fact that, in the Bram Stoker tale, the gypsies are portrayed as these servants of the count. But here in America, it's almost as if the Roma have taken the Count Dracula and plopped it in Jersey and are now running it as a carnival attraction. And he liked that idea, But so after dealing with the pop culture aspect of it, I started researching the history of Dracula as intellectual property. Because the idea is that you take this image of Dracula, and you can turn it into something that people are willing to pay money for. And of course, in Wildwood, they did that with a carnival attraction. But nobody's done that like Hollywood. So I sat there on my couch, and I watched, dozens and dozens of vampire movies until I thought I was going to go out of my mind. And I began to do research on what had happened to the figure of Dracula after the initial Universal Pictures Dracula. And the interesting thing I found that is among lawyers in the intellectual property, in the lore of intellectual property law, the case of Lugosi v. Universal, i.e. Bela Lugosi's son suing Universal Pictures, is one of these cases that kicked off a revolution in intellectual property law. What happened is that Bela Jr., Bela's son, who looks exactly like his dad if he were taller and kind of better looking and fit and Californian, Like, you can just see the Californian-ness in him, you know? Like, he just looks like he's happy in a way that I'm not, you know? But Bella, he became a corporate attorney, which I love. You know, King of the Undead, and his son becomes a corporate attorney in Los Angeles. It's just, you can't write this stuff up. But he saw that Universal Pictures was marketing the image of his dad after the movie came out. And they were putting it, you know, to sell all kinds of products. And he began to realize that what Universal was marketing was not just a piece of property rights that they owned, but they were marketing the image of his dad. They were marketing the way his dad looked in that tuxedo, in that cape. And I mean, if you see, you know, Universal Dracula, Bella makes that movie. So he sued Universal for like more than a decade. He was in court, you know, trying to argue that there was such a thing as a publicity right that's independent of a trademark right. In other words, that a celebrity has a sort of intrinsic right to the way they look, right? That Universal can't buy, that it transfers down from Bella to Bella Jr. and then to Bella's descendants. And what happened is, you know, the courts eventually agreed with them, but they said that it doesn't survive death. So, in 1985, Bella, you know, who's also very prominent politically, he had a lot of pull, they passed the Celebrities' Rights Act in California, which changed all that, and basically allowed this right to be transferable. So, you know, the family of anybody, you know, who is famous can actually theoretically assert some kind of right that, you know, the trademark owners can't take. And the legal cases that happened after that were crazy. You know, in the mid-1980s, Johnny Carson sued a toilet company for using the phrase, "Here's Johnny," to market their line of portable crappers. In 1988, Bette Midler sued Ford for an ad featuring a sort of gravelly voice that sounded like hers. She argued that her voice was signature. It was something that she owned as right of publicity. The 1993 case of White v. Samsung topped it all. The electronics company featured a futuristic episode of Wheel of Fortune in which a robot in a dress and blonde wig spun letters from the game show board. And Vanna White successfully argued something we all suspected for years, that there was no real difference between the droid and her. And she won. She won. That robot is me. She won. And the problem is, as these rights, you know, George Wendt and John Ratzenberger sued a company for marketing a Hank and Bob figure. One was a mailman, the other was a fat guy at a theme restaurant based on Cheers. The problem is, as these cases exploded with these celebrities suing people, the notion of what a celebrity actually has that's his right became anything and everything. It could be a blonde wig. It could be, you know, a voice. It could be a catchphrase, you know. And the rights got to the point where judges started rebelling against that. There's a dissenting judge who wrote that, you know, a Seinfeld spinoff ends up in a bizarre world where a skinny Newman, you know, because Newman sues, sits down to coffee with a svelte George, a stocky Kramer, a fat Jerry, and a lanky blonde Elaine. In other words, all of the characters say, well, you can't use a character that looks like me for your show. And as a result, what's the worth of Seinfeld? You know, nothing. You know, the ownership of Seinfeld is completely destroyed by these people coming out of the woodwork. Okay, so that's fine. This is perfect. But the problem is, I began to realize that that, you know, you could go too far the other way. Like anybody who's ever seen those dead celebrity actors that have been digitally re-put into a commercial doesn't doubt that if people have complete right to do whatever they want with a celebrity image, we would soon live in a world where Mahatma Gandhi sold Omaha steaks and Jimmy Stewart did porn. You know, that's my, sorry. But the problem is, what could happen if someone from Vlad's family, who himself was this image that was stolen by Bram Stoker and then turned into this icon. In places like Tennessee, that as long as you prove continuous commercial use, it goes on, the right can be transferred forever. So what if a Tennessean who can claim direct descendant from Vlad the Impaler's family comes out of the woodwork? They theoretically could sue the entire industry that's been making money off the guy for so long. And then I came to another thing. You see, you know, in the middle of this Dracula movie, I saw that, you know, Keanu Reeves, he's completely emotionless. Everybody knows that. It's particularly bad in Dracula. I was at first he looked like a Labrador retriever that had been hit on the nose with a rolled up newspaper, you know, and then it looked like he didn't have a central nervous system. And eventually I realized that there was a supernatural character to his emotionlessness. But if an actor can claim a voice or blonde hair as his or her trademark, what about Keanu Reeves' dull, emotionless performance? He might not be part of... He's spent the last 20 years establishing that as his characteristic acting style. He's made it his own. And that makes him potentially the most powerful man in the industry, because if bland acting is Keanu's trademark, he might be able to get a cut out of almost every bad film made today. Every overpaid A-lister sleepwalking through an action blockbuster, every porn star lying on her back and going through the motions, every classically trained Shakespearean actor making a kid's film with a talking dog and a soundtrack crapped out by Elton John because the money was too good to pass out. Keanu could get a piece of all of that and more. His winnings are potentially unlimited. And that's what scared me. Yeah, thank you. Yeah. We have time for the question and answer.
Yeah, go ahead. I'd say about 15 minutes. Question.
Yeah, we'll do a short question and answer session. Yes?
I want to thank you for coming today.
Thank you.
And I'm curious if you had seen... about 5 years ago on USA that was about Vlad the Impaler, not about Dracula. And I was wondering if you came across it, what you thought of its treatment.
Oh, that's the thing. I know what you're talking about. I have not seen that actual movie. I believe it's probably based on the... because most of the popular treatments of Vlad's life are based on a series of books by Raymond T. McNally and Radu Florescu. And... they have wonderful stuff on a lot of on unearthing the legends of Vlad the Impaler. The only problem with their work is that they, once we get into Stoker, you know, and what he knows, they play fast and loose with the truth. But whenever you see popular, one thing I have found in general is that popular portrayals of Vlad the Impaler tend to follow the McNally-Florescu model. And that's good stuff. Those guys, they went out to the home country and they listened to all the peasant legends. Of course, that's the problem. A lot of this stuff is oral history about Vlad the Impaler. So, you know, whenever you see some case of Vlad doing something particularly nasty, you do have to know that it was a specific incident was probably told from one peasant to another for maybe a couple hundred years before it got written down. Yes.
Thank you for coming. Do you think Bram Stoker was inspired by folkloric vampires outside of the legend of Dracula to inspire his novel?
Yes. As a matter of fact, we know that because many of the books that he lists are vampire tales that are not just in Romania. And in fact, some people have said, and I don't have the notes right in front of me, but I believe a lot of the vampire stuff comes from Ireland. You know, his own history growing up and learning some of the Irish lore. It's also inspired by, you got to understand that he kind of came late to the party. Like, Dracula's published in 1897, but all the other Victorian penny dreadfuls and, you know, bodice rippers and vampire tales, like, you know, Polidori's The Vampire, you know, which was loosely based on, you know, Lord Byron, or James Malcolm Rymer's Varney the Vampire that, you know, these are, and also... Le Fanu's Carmilla, these all were published at least a decade or so, and I think in many cases a couple of decades before Bram Stoker even started writing Dracula. So he not only had a folkloric base, he also had a very well-established genre of Victorian vampire fiction to kind of jump from. Yes.
Thank you for coming. I know that Stoker put a lot of his own interpretations of what Dracula looked like on Henry Irving.
Right.
What would you say went into the formulation of the characters Nosferatu and the Bela Lugosi Dracula that you think of today? What factors went into their appearance?
Well, Nosferatu is, I mean, I think Nosferatu is fascinating because he's so vermin-like. He's got that bulbous head and the sort of rat-like ears. And I think that's I think when you watch the movie, you can very clearly see that he's something that you can very clearly see that the guy wanted to make him very much inhuman. And in fact, in some ways, because you know that Nosferatu is loosely based on Dracula, and they changed some of the details to avoid legal trouble, and then they got that legal trouble anyway. You know, Florence Stoker, Bram's widow, forced them to burn almost all the copies of Nosferatu. But one thing is that image of Dracula as this feral, you know, rat-like person, that very much comes from Stoker's portrayal of the Count, because the Count isn't this, and in fact, I think Bela is more the leap. Bela is more the jump into something completely new. And the thing about Bela is, he started out as a romantic lead. Like, one of the very first leads that he ever played was a Hungarian version of Romeo and Juliet. And one thing he talked about, and in fact, when Dracula was first launched back in, I guess, I think it was 31, I'm not positive. But when Dracula was first launched, it was the premiere was on Valentine's Day, and the caption was "The Strangest Love Story Ever Told." So I think it came out of the persona of Bela Lugosi, who, you know, he was this romantic figure. And incidentally, he said that he got more fan letters from women for his portrayal of Dracula than he ever did for his portrayal of Romeo. Any? Yes?
Thanks for coming. I'd like to, see if you have any advice to people considering a career of travel writing.
I've actually talked to editors about that, and one thing they hate is when people actually pitch them, the idea of send me to a place. I what I think would be neat is if you gave me a whole bunch of money and I just show up, at a different. And editors are the stingiest people in the world. They just do not want to send you anywhere. They want everything on expense. So the big thing about that, what I would do is, and it's like a lot of writing where you start out by doing it on spec. And what I would do is the next time you are planning something, try to make it an adventure. Try to plan something, and then try to come back and write. Maybe take notes while you're there, write after the fact, and break into it that way. And as far as writing a book, it helps if you start by getting an article published. So the article starts by you taking the trip on your own and just saying, I want to go, and you should be going to a place you want to go anywhere. You should be going to a place that kind of inspires you, that you're going to go all by yourself. And then what you come up with afterwards, that might get your foot in the door. Yeah. Yes?
First of all, thank you for coming.
Thank you.
We have a lot of interesting speakers, and you certainly very interesting.
Thank you.
And you're great style. First of all, what's the best Dracula film in terms of being gross and entertaining, even though you're a little accurate, I guess, in terms of the novel? And what do you say about modern vampires in the most religious occult sense?
Oh, yeah. Well, I didn't have time to get into the lifestyle, the lifestylers or the people that spell the name vampire with a Y. But there are people, and they do. They claim it's the original Latin, which Latin doesn't have Ys. That's not the original spelling, and the language doesn't work that way. But, that's... there are people, they believe that they can transfer energy from one person to the other, either psychically, just by focusing on them, or that the energy which they sometimes call prana, using a Hindu word. And it's Hindu by way of California. It's not Hindu by way of, you know, Bengal. I'm sorry, not Bengal, Mumbai. So they call this energy prana. It's concentrated in the blood, or they can absorb it directly. Okay. And one thing that I found that's interesting, among paranormal beliefs, it's very similar to another belief called breatharianism, that these people, they have nothing to do with the vampire subculture, but they believe they can absorb, as a weight loss remedy and a way of getting good health, that you can absorb energy directly from the cosmos and you don't need to eat. Now, what the vampires believe is that, yes, you need to eat, but you supplement it with these feedings, okay? And to keep yourself sane and healthy. And they define that in a very vague way. So what the vampires have done is created an untestable form of breatharianism. It's also much safer, because every once in a while, park rangers, and I'm serious, there are cases in news reports, park rangers will come upon the desiccated body of a breatharian who's been out in the woods for like 3 days, you know, and what happened to them happens to all of us when we stop eating. You die. Oh, but as far as the best, I'm going to tweak your question a little, the best vampire film instead of the best Dracula film, and it's a vampire film that I really recommend everybody go out and get. It's very hard to, it's on Netflix, but it's not the kind of thing that's in the blockbuster. It's called Vampire, and it's actually with a Y but no E. It's Vampyr. And it was a 1920s German film in which it was in the infancy of the talkies. And the guy plays around with this new technique of using sound so that the sound sometimes sounds distant and sometimes it sounds up close. And he purposefully muddies the film. And he does some of the creepiest things that have ever been done on film. And it's a wonder. It's even more, the shots in that film are even more unsettling than Nosferatu, which is, I think, runs a close second. And as far as Dracula, I'd also see the Spanish language Dracula film, which usually comes bundled in the DVD with the English version. Because A, the Spanish language, it was done with the same sets and and at the same time as filming the English version. The Spanish language people would work in, you know, they would split up shifts so that the Spanish would come in the morning and the English people would come in the evening, and they'd use the same sets and alternate. And the Spanish language actors are much more expressive. The women are dressed in ways that are much more provocative, like the costumers weren't afraid of boobs, like they're, you know, the obvious, the Anglos, you know. And you know, Renfield's portrayal, Mina Harker's portrayal are just much more riveting, you know. I think Bella still has the title of best, you know, Dracula. Sorry, I talked your ear off about that one, but any others? Mr. Coleman.
I'm curious as to, you have two boys.
Yes.
And day in and day out, how does your interest in all of these things transfer to them? Do you spring out of the closet and scare them?
No.
What sort of stories do you read to them? And finally, How does Halloween play out in your house, and what role do you have in Halloween?
For Halloween, I'm the guy, and you know, by the look of me, you can tell this. I'm the guy that sits on the porch with the bag of candy, and I eat about a third of it. And, you know, my wife has to take away. The kids, you know, little Thomas, my one-year-old, he's going to dress up like a bat. But the three-year-old is dressing up as Thomas the Tank Engine. I try not to. You know, my dad wanted me to go to military academy, and I became a writer. I don't want to put my writer, you know, vampire thing on. But my three-year-old does know some of the lyrics to Bela Lugosi's Dead by Bauhaus, because I play it all the time. And I can actually say, "Where's Bela Lugosi, honey?" And he'll go, "He's dead!" Which is a terrible, terrible thing to teach your toddler, but, you know. Is that... We're done. Yeah. Thank you very much. Thank you.